Okay, well, when Chris asked me to teach, I thought, I have absolutely nothing to teach. Because I taught pretty recently, and usually takes a while for anything to germinate within me. And I said that to Sherry, and Sherry said, well, you know, you taught on meekness last time, and I want to know, she was kind of joking, she goes, I want to know what's a quick 3-point way to get meek. How do you do it? And, you know, my initial response was life, you know. Life kind of takes the cockiness out of you. But I realize it's not a very satisfactory or scriptural response. But anyhow, I went back and I started looking at the Bible, and I want to share what I found. I must be nervous. I'm still shivering and I'm warmer. But, you know, my initial response was not entirely wrong. You know, there is a way life has of taking the cockiness out of us. Have y'all ever heard of Ted Williams, the baseball player? Well, he just died, and I don't know much about baseball, but I was reading the little article on him, and it was a real gracious article talking about what a fantastic baseball player he was. Evidently, there's never been anyone that approached his batting average. But in a gracious way, reading between the lines, you could also tell that he had been kind of a jerk in his time. You know, it didn't say that, but you could just read. It talked about how he had alienated many of the sports writers and had lost being most valuable player because they wouldn't vote for him because he was such a, he was very confident in his abilities and didn't have any problem sharing that with people. But then it said, it talked about later in his life how they had honored him someplace and how much it had touched him. And it said, you know, he had obviously mellowed with age. And I think age does have a way of mellowing us because we begin to find out just how short we fall in a lot of ways, a lot shorter than we think we're going to. But, you know, age doesn't always mellow you. If you ever go to the nursing home to do ministry, some of those people... Some of those people have not got it all out of them. And when you get to be older, your facility to cover up what's inside becomes significantly reduced. It's all right on the surface. And you know, you got these sweet looking little old men cursing like sailors and these sweet looking little old women who are just bitter, and it just comes out the minute you speak to them, you know. And so you can't rely on life. And I think as Christians, I think that the Lord's cockiness removal program is a much more focused and intense one because he has an interest in our lives bearing fruit for him. And if he leaves it to natural resources and to our own inclinations, it's likely never to happen. So I started looking at the scripture at what we might find there, and we're going to look at the story of someone we're all familiar with who had a little problem with pride, and that's Peter. But before I go there, how many of y'all know that Jesus is unlike anything that we've ever encountered in the world? That his gentleness, his meekness, his ability to overlook our offenses against him, his willingness to always see what is best in us, rather than see what everybody else sees, which is what's worst in us. You know, and his incredible patience and, you know, Jesus was more meek. Jesus was meekness personified, and it defied the world. The world did not recognize him when he came because they were looking for someone who would move in power. And what the world expects from people is that you will take care of number one, you will look out for yourself. In fact, I noticed that on the internet, one of the best-selling books is one Oprah Winfrey wrote. I don't remember the title, but it was something about why self is important. Have y'all seen that book, or I just saw it the first time? Really? And that's the world. The world is why self is important. And Jesus, not only did he tell us that you must deny yourself, but he was the personification of someone who lived for other people's interest and not his own. And, you know, it says that as a sheep he was led to slaughter and he opened not his mouth. And throughout, ever since the fall of man, the way God has been trying to bring the world to him is through an example of people which is so different from the surrounding world that it stands out and is unique, and there's something about it. People will either hate it or be drawn to it, but it's different. And he did that initially with the nation of Israel by giving them the law. And although the Bible tells us that what's right and what's wrong is written in our conscience and that we all know it, even the tribes that have never heard of Christ, in our conscience, he has given us a witness of right and wrong. Never before had a country codified the law that was so moral, so decent, and so based on loving your neighbor as the law that was given to Israel. It was a compassionate, a moral, and a decency that was a light to the people around them because the world around them was extremely violent and cruel. And there was very little of thought that you would consider the good of someone else. That was not normal. So he sets up this nation that's to be a light, so different, so decent, so orderly, and so based on morality and what is good that people would either be drawn from it or repelled. But it was a mixed success because Israel did not truly follow the law. Instead, they followed the customs of the world around them. And then his next example was Christ himself, who came to earth to manifest what God was really like to the earth. And for the years that Christ was on the earth and in ministry, he was a perfect example of what God's heart is like. And for that reason, he is called the light of the world. He was the light that shone forth in the incredible darkness of the world what God is like, trying to get people to see, to snap. And the way he's doing that is contrasting himself. He's light, the world is dark. People are going to notice, and people did notice. And the darkness hated it and killed him. But there were those who were drawn to the light in him. And after Christ was gone, he set forth the church. And the church is called in Matthew 5 a city set upon a hill. Let your light so shine before men that they see the good works that you do and glorify God who is in heaven. And so his way of drawing people to himself now is through the church. And it's not through what the church preaches, although preaching is very important. The proclamation of the gospel can bring salvation. But it's not through what they say. It's through who they are and what they look like. That we are to be so different in our character and in the way that we respond to the world that people will notice. And that's why he says you're a city set upon the hill. And he means that as individuals, and he means that collectively. That the church collectively is to be so distinct and different that people around it notice it and will either hate it or will be drawn to it. And I think that this is something that is gets very lost. It gets very lost in our understanding. And you can read many times, an example that came to my mind was if you've ever studied history, there was a movement started to abolish slavery called the abolitionist movement. Now, their cause was just and moral. Slavery is an abomination, and they knew that. But if you listen and hear the words that they say and watch their actions, they became very violent and strident and hard in their means. In other words, they thought any means would justify their end because their end was a moral one. But what people failed to see in them was meekness. And I just often wondered, there was a preacher who was a very famous preacher during that time named Peter Cartwright, and he had been involved in what was called the Second Great Awakening. It was the Cane Ridge Revival in Kentucky, which if you've ever read about it, it's just a fantastic thing. It was the most godless group of people. They were a generation who had not been taught about God. God had largely been vacated from their experience, and they come out into the frontier, and they're just as hard and tough and as capable a people. But there is no God, and just for a few men praying, this incredible revival hits Kentucky, and it becomes one of the most moral and decent places through salvation. Individuals, just incredible stories of salvation. And one of the preachers behind that was a guy named Peter Cartwright, who was just a shining example of a man given to the gospel. And he got interested in slavery, and he got interested in the abolitionist movement, and he even got involved in it and made a real stand. But he later disavowed that movement because he said they were unchristian in the way they handled it. And what he would do is he would go down and he would love these slave owners. He would just go down there and he would minister the meekness and the love of Christ to them, and they would open their plantations up to revival meetings, and just slaves and slave owners alike would just get saved. And then he'd leave. He wouldn't tell them what to do. It was then up to God to deal with their hearts. And you just wonder, you know, you can't really fault the abolitionists. They really want it to do the right thing. But if they don't truly know the ways of God in their heart, you try to make it happen in the flesh because you think it's right. And I just think the church has fallen into that. You see it with the abortionist movement. There's nothing more, you know, a bigger abomination to God than the killing of babies. And yet, blowing up abortion clinics is not what Jesus would do. We just, there's somehow the meekness of Christ gets removed. And the response politically that you see in the church to different things that are really wrong so often sounds so strident and so self-justifying, and what Christ wants is for them to see him. Without meekness, no matter how right your cause is, people will not see Jesus in it. And that's the thing that makes it different. You got to take a stand for what's right and wrong. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong. You have to stand up for what's right and wrong. But if the meekness of Christ is not in you, you're going to end up being self-righteous and a bully, and you're going to try to make it happen in the flesh. You know, and it's up to God to change people's hearts. But what they need is to see God. And when they see God and they still harden their hearts, it's between them and God. And so I think the meekness is the very heart of what we as a church need to be seeking. And I wanted to look at the example of Peter. I don't know, you know, how do you become meek? I don't know, you know. Life, I said. So I thought about one thing that Jesus had said to Peter, and from there I just started looking at the whole story again, and there's just a lot to learn. And, you know, basically what I learned is how gracious God is and that it's him who does it. You know, I could stop right there. You know, seek God, he'll do it, right? But I want to look at what he said to Peter. If you look, first of all, at Matthew verse 26, I want to make the case that Peter had a problem with pride. Now, in this story, of course, Jesus is about to go. He's about to be arrested. And they've had the Last Supper. Matthew 26 and verse 31. And Jesus warns them, "You will all fall away because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." And Peter answered him, "Though they all fail you, I never will." So what Peter was saying here is, I'm better than them. They're going to fail you, I never will. Sounds pretty arrogant, doesn't it? But, you know, the other disciples were no better, because in two different places that I can think of in Scripture, they argue among themselves about which is the greatest. I mean, it's kind of funny. And they're with Jesus and these guys. I mean, you kind of think that's kind of out there. I mean, I've been going to this church for 12, 13 years, and I can't remember ever getting into an outward discussion with a group of people about which of us is the greater, you know? But are we really that much different? Maybe we're just not as open as they are. You know, it's still there. It's in our hearts. We just don't have open discussions about it because we know better. You know, so we hide it. But the truth is if the disciples felt that way, don't we? You know, don't we? And I want to look at this same story in another place, Luke 22. I'm right at that place in my life when my Bible's getting kind of hard to read. And I had LASIK surgery, and I went and had my checkup, and I thought they were going to say, oh, you know, it didn't work. They said, your eyes are great. They're just responding great. And I said, well, then why is it the print in my Bible's a little blurry. And he said, well, how old are you? I said, don't say anything more, okay. He said, there's nothing we can do about that. Okay, Luke 22, verse 33. Peter says to Jesus, he says, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Now, I want you to look at the first thing he says. He says, Lord, I am ready. See, Peter thought he was capable. Peter thought he was ready. You know, he didn't even ask Jesus, you know, am I ready? He said, I am ready. He knew. He was just pretty sure of himself. But, you know, even though he saw himself as capable, Jesus knew just how capable Peter was and what he was capable of. So if you'll flip over to John 13, I want to look at the same thing in another, even yet another gospel. In verse 36, this is another look at the same story. Simon Peter said to Jesus, Lord, where are you going? Because Jesus has just alluded to the fact that he is leaving them. And Jesus says, where I am going, you cannot follow me now. Now, this is the same Peter that said, I am ready. But Jesus says, you can't follow me now, but you will follow me afterwards. See, this is the correct assessment of Peter. And this is, in many ways, Jesus' assessment of most of us in this room. You are not ready now, but you will be. You see, there's both a hard, realistic assessment of where we're at, which is very difficult, and there's a tremendous amount of grace for where he knows we will be. You see that? He doesn't cut Peter off, says, you're not ready, you know, leave me alone. He says, but you will be. I wonder how often Jesus thought about that in the days and months to come when he went through the biggest trial of his life. I wonder if he ever thought back that Jesus said, but I will be. There's hope. You know, he holds out hope, but he at the same time gives Peter a correct assessment of where he's at right then. He's not ready. And I tell you, that's exactly where most of us are, especially when we're young in the Lord. You know, we come in, we want a ministry. We want to do things. We're ready. And, I've seen people come and go, and they want to preach. They want to do this. They want to do that. And the word of the Lord to them is, you're not ready. But if you hang in there, if you're willing to hang in there, you will be. And I think that speaks to all of us who get impatient with where we're at in the Lord. And I just want to do something, you know. I'm ready. I'm ready, Lord. And the Lord's going, but I see you. I see your heart. You're not ready. You know. So what are you going to do? You can go out there and make it happen yourself, or are you going to wait until I say you are, you know? See, Jesus knew that right then, if Peter were to do the things he said, if he were to go to prison and to die for Jesus, that it would be for Peter's glory. You know, how great Peter was, how great a disciple Peter was. But Jesus wanted to wait until the time when Peter's death would be for Christ's glory. It wouldn't be about Peter at all. It would be about Jesus. Unfortunately, that's a process. That's not something that happens overnight. If Peter had to wait for that, then surely we do. And Jesus knew that there was a hard reality about the fall in Peter's life. And we all know what happens. Peter denies Christ rather than goes to prison or puts himself in harm's way to protect him. Instead, he outwardly denies ever knowing him. I mean, he quickly found out what was really in him. So I want to look at the story of Jesus' restoration of Peter in John chapter 21. They have a conversation, which has always been one of my favorite parts of the Bible because it's so personal, this conversation between these two people. Jesus has died and he has been resurrected and he appears to the disciples who are out fishing. And it's so much mirrors the very first time that Peter had ever encountered Jesus. Have y'all ever noticed how much it mirrors it? You know, Peter's out fishing, and Jesus says, if you cast your net on the other side, you'll catch all these fish. And Peter does, and Peter goes, well, get away from me, Lord. I am a sinner. And he goes through life, and he and he gets affirmed by Jesus, and he's Jesus's main man, and this pride comes up in him, and he gets cut to the quick. And then Jesus meets him again, and the same thing happens. They're out on the lake, and he says, throw your net on the other side and catch all these fish. I mean, that's not an accident. You know, Jesus is evidently saying, Peter, you're still my man. You know, the call of God is without repentance on a life. And, you know, how many times we fail and fall and everything. When Jesus calls us, Jesus calls us. And so Peter jumps in and he swims to the shore. And we all know the story. Three times, Jesus asked him, do you love me more than these? He's getting right at that thing that said, you know, even though they would do you wrong, I never would. And he says to Peter, feed my lambs. Three times. And what he's saying is, I want you to serve those whom you have once thought you were better than. I mean, isn't that the heart of Jesus? Feed the very ones that you would want to be pastor over and leader of. The very one you want to be the man, get on your knees and feed them. Stop caring about your position or your place. And take care of the needs around you, the people that you see. In whatever capacity do you have, be it great or be it small, start looking at the people around you and meeting the needs around you. Get your mind off what the position is or what place that might take. You know, it makes me think of the story of the prodigal son. You know, the prodigal son left home a son, and he came home. Remember what he said, the servants in my father's house fare better than this. I'll go home and make myself a servant. He left home a son. He came back a servant, you know. And I think that's what has to happen to us. We come to Jesus, and we, you know, and we fall, and we see our weakness. And we finally, we come back a servant. And what happens when we come back a servant? You know, he puts the robe on us, puts the ring on us, you know, lifts us up. See, Jesus was just showing the way to Peter. Now, if you look down at verse 18, the last time Jesus says, feed my sheep, he says a little bit more to him. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. Now, this was the sentence that came into my mind when I was thinking, how do you become meek? See, Jesus right here, he says, when you were young, when you were old. He's contrasting immaturity, spiritual immaturity, with what maturity is. And this is the way he sums it up. And basically he says, when you're young, when you're immature in the Lord, you do what you want to do. You're free to come. Your time is your own. Now, you may give some to the Lord, and you may give some to others, and you may feel pretty good about it because, you know, I'm giving time, I'm giving this, I'm giving that, but you're still the one who's doing it. You're in control. You come and go, and if you don't feel like doing it, you can find a good reason for it. If you don't feel like coming to church, and I'm talking to myself, you can find a good reason for it. You know, you're still master of your own self. You come and you go, and if anybody impinges upon that right, there's a problem. If anybody challenges your right to come and go and tries to tell you what to do with your time, then there's a problem. You know, everything's cool as long as I can say yes or no. Everything's cool as long as I am ultimately in control. You try to take that away from me, there is a problem. You see that? You come and go as you please in America. We come and go as we please in America. We're hungry. We go to the refrigerator. You know, we need something, we go to the store. Can you imagine being in a place like Cuba where you're hungry, there's no place to go? You do not have the power to take care of your own basic needs. But how much more they must know about meekness. Because we take care of our own needs. We have medicine. We need medicine. We call the doctor. You know, we're used to coming and going as we please. And Jesus wants to challenge that in us. If you would mature. What about our money? You know, what happens if we're asked to give more than we're comfortable with? You know? Or whatever it may be. It's just the freedom to remain in the control of our lives. But Jesus says, when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and they will take you where you do not want to go. But I want to show you something. He's talking about the cross. You know, he's prophesying that Peter would one day die as a martyr, just as he said he would. And Jesus affirmed it. You know, where I go, you cannot go, but you will go. He affirmed that. And he affirms it again. He's talking to Peter. One day you will stretch out your hands and they will take you where you don't want to go, and that's to die for me. You will pay the ultimate price for me. But I want you to notice that that Peter stretches out his own hands. Nobody makes him do it. It doesn't say they come and they take you captive. He submitted to it. He let them lead him there. And see, I think I was starting out that meekness is the cross. That meekness is worked in our life by yielding to the cross. But as I looked at it, it seems like the Lord says, humble yourself. And the way to humble yourself is to submit to that cross in the first place. You have to say yes. Nobody can make you get under discipline. Nobody can make you submit to that thing which you don't want to submit to. You have to. It has to be your will to do it. And it doesn't happen overnight. See, I think most of, and Chris has said this, and I'm beginning to really believe it's true, that most of the work of God in our lives right now is to get us to the place where we will submit to the cross. It's not the cross itself. We think this thing that's causing me pain is my cross. Maybe it is, but maybe it's your resistance of it. Maybe it's your resistance and not wanting it that's causing the pain. And it's really not the cross itself, because, you know, once you get on the cross, you stop wiggling. And you die. And it doesn't bother you anymore. And so I think that what Jesus is saying through Peter to us is twofold. He's saying, number one, you're not ready. But number two, you will be if you hang in there, because he follows up by saying to him, follow me. You see, that was the last thing he said. Do you remember that's the first thing that, I'm sorry, it's in verse 19. This he said to show by what kind of death Peter was to glorify God. Notice he said that he says to glorify God, not glorify Peter. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. Follow me. In other words, he's saying, if you want to glorify me, I've got two words for you. And it's the same two words for each of us here. Follow me. That was the first thing he said to Peter, too. Y'all remember? He said, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. It's the last recorded thing he says to him, too. Follow me. In other words, there's only one solution, and that's to follow Christ. To get up every day and to make it our business to follow Jesus. You know, I like to read, and you read in these biographies and history and stuff, these great men of God who've done tremendous things that a lot of them we never heard of. They're not necessarily big names, but I was reading recently about somebody, Randy, you may have heard of, Francis Asbury. I'd heard his name on Methodist Church, Asbury Methodist Church. I had no idea who he was, but he was a circuit rider, which meant that he went from church to church to church to church to church. And he would be on a horse constantly. For the majority of his life, he was on a horse. And these guys won, these real hardened settlers to the Lord, because they would get on their horse and ride even though the weather outside was absolutely, I mean, they'd bring their animals in, but the Methodist riders would go out. Even in snow and sleet and rain. And there used to be a saying that said the weather's not fit for anybody, but I can't remember, mules and Methodist preachers. Because they'd go out in it. But they so respected, and these settlers so respected that, you know, that these weren't prima donnas, you know, preaching at them and not getting out there, that they'd listen to them. And a lot of guys got saved. And they tell a story about... I can't remember, it was one of the preachers, one of these circuit riders came to an inn and wanted admittance, and they said, well, are you a Methodist or a Presbyterian? And he said, why does it matter? And he goes, well, the Methodists all are real particular about how their horses are kept, and the Presbyterians are all particular about their own rooms. And he goes, well, I happen to be Presbyterian, but my horse is a Methodist. But these guys, I mean, these guys are really out there. And I start thinking, you know, they called the disciples in Acts, they called them the men who turned the world upside down. And I was thinking the difference between, I mean, you can live a life that turns the world upside down, or you can live a life that basically leaves it pretty much unchanged when you leave. Now, some people have lived a life that have changed it significantly for the worse. I don't think most of us will do that. Most of us will probably leave it pretty much the way it was, or we'll leave it better. And I think the difference is in the revelation of the cross in our lives and our willingness to embrace it. Because to the degree that it's about Jesus and not about us is the degree it will bear fruit. And you know, I was thinking about Chris preaches on rewards and how, you know, the way you live your life down here determines the reward you get in heaven. And sometimes that just doesn't connect with me very much. But I start thinking about it in recently, and it's just been connecting a little bit more with me, because yeah, he's always said that reward determined your closeness to Jesus. In my mind, that's always meant proximity, which is a hard thing to relate to. But it's really not about proximity. It's about closeness. It's about emotional and spiritual. It's about friendship. You know, everybody's got friends, and they've got different degrees of friendships with them. You know, some you let all the way in. Some you're just comfortable around. Some you're just acquaintances with. But the degree that in this lifetime we learn to open our hearts up to Jesus is the degree our hearts will be open for eternity. And that doesn't mean he will love any, I mean, the love he has for us will be no less. Our capacity to appreciate him will be greater. Even in heaven. You know, there's a lot of people who don't want heaven in their hearts. You know, there's a lot of people who have closed their hearts to that and don't want Jesus. There's a lot of people who do, but I think that that grows in us, and the closer and closer that we become to the Lord, it's an eternal thing. The more we submit to the cross in this lifetime, the more we learn to love him and learn obedience to him, is the more that we will be able to, we're going to spend our whole life, our whole eternity worshiping the Lord. And I just think the capacity to appreciate him and to be close to him and be friends with him is going to be so much greater if we pursue it in this lifetime. And then there's a final lesson in these scriptures. If you look down on verse, I think it's 20. It says, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, which was John, following them, the one who had been reclining at the table close to him, and had said, Lord, who is it that's going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about this man? And Jesus says to him, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? And then it says a rumor started that the man would never die. But Jesus only said, if it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? And I think the final lesson the Lord would have us in learning to follow him is to take your eyes off of other people. See, I wonder, you know, with pride comes jealousy, because we want to be the man and we don't like it when somebody else appears to be, you know? And I just wonder, because Peter wanted to be the man, and that wasn't completely dead with him in spite of the fact that he'd had this fall. You know, he had to walk with Jesus a while. And every day he walked with him, he got, you know, closer and closer. But I just wonder if Peter had maybe wasn't a bit jealous of John. Because John was the disciple that many believe was closest to Christ and reclined at the table with him. It says that put his head on his bosom. And you wonder if Peter may not have noticed that and said, no, wait a second, I'm the man, I'm the rock, I got the keys, who's this guy, you know? And I think Jesus was speaking to that. He was saying, see, we look at the leaders, we look at all this kind of stuff, and we think they're the man, but I want to tell you who it is, it's you. Jesus called you, you're the one, You're the one his attention's on. You're the one he called out of darkness. You're the one he put into light, and you're the one he's got plans for. And I don't know what the plans are. They may not be anything that ever draws attention to them, but they can draw attention of heaven. If you can just take your eyes off what the world wants you to look at and understand that Jesus, see, it's all Jesus. It's like Bo was saying on Friday, the reason you're saved is because Jesus chose to save you. It's all Jesus. It's not us. And he had a reason and he had a purpose. And he calls us into a body because he knows that in a body, all this junk is going to come up in us. This competitiveness, this pride, this fear of not being chosen, this fear of being rejected, this fear of people liking other people better than you, all that stuff. And I'm sorry, it's in every human being. And if you act like it's not, you're just not dealing with it. It's just, if it's in the disciples, it's in us, right? And he draws, and I tell you, there's a lot of churches you walk into and you think they walk on water. You know, bigger churches, and there's a lot of churches you don't. You can tell a difference. There's just a life. And he calls us together, and the scum rises to the top. Yeah, he scrapes it off. And the scum rises to the top, and he scrapes it off, right? And Hallie can relate. Tell us, Hallie. And how much you allow the scum to rise to the top is how pure you're going to be. How much you keep it hidden and stuffed down in there is how much longer it's going to take. He's still going to keep the heat up. You know, he's going to keep the heat up to the very last day. You know, but the scum's got to rise to the top. So come, let's fellowship together. Let's enjoy sweet, sweet times with one another in the fellowship of the Lord. You know, Chris asked me to preach, and I thought, nothing's happening in my life. And this morning, I was in my quiet time, I thought, what a stupid thing to say. I've had my feelings majorly hurt about 5 or 6 times since the last time I stood up here. Majorly hurt. You know, you think that's not the Lord? I've just been reeling from this going, okay, you know? And that doesn't happen all the time, you know? But it's just lately, it's just been one after another. I told Darlene, I said, you know, I was telling her, I said, don't worry, my feelings are just easy to hurt. They're out there right now. I don't know why. And people are stepping on them. Bless you all. I thank you for contributing to my spiritual growth. Oh, it's so hard. It is so hard. And y'all all know it is, don't you? It just, you know, this morning it's like all the stuff from my past. All the old feelings that you run and you run and you run to escape, they're just sitting there. And you know why they're sitting there? It's because I kept getting my feelings hurt. And it just makes you have to go deep. You know? You just have to go deep. Because my feelings aren't getting hurt because of any big deal. It's because there's something in there. You know, he's hitting something in there. And he's hitting something in there that I'd like to run away from, quite frankly. But I don't want to. I want to, but I don't want to. You know, because I lived in the world for 27 years. And I never found anything as good as Jesus. And I never found anybody who, regardless of how scummy I am or how much I act, would not only be there for me, but give me hope. He'd say, you may not be there, but you will be. You will be. Just affirmation. If you just stick in there, it's all about me. All you have to do is hang in there and get up and walk with me and do your very best. And when you fall, get up. Or when you fall, stick your hand up and let somebody help you up. You know, don't think you got to do it yourself, right? And this is the lesson I learned from Peter. You know, he didn't ever once revile Peter for not being where Peter thought he ought to be. Instead, he said, you know, you're not there, but you're going to be. He saw it in Peter. And then he just said, follow me. Now, I've known a lot of people come to this church, and quite a few of them I've become friends with and really learned to care about who are not here anymore. And there's a lot of legitimate reasons for that. But what I saw happen over and over again is that that thing inside of them got hit. And it was just too dangerous being here, you know, and they went to safer climbs, and God still loves him, and he's still going to get that thing out of him if he can. You know, but that's the thing, and I would venture to guess almost every person in here struggles in the same areas of just root rejection, and deep down inside of all of us, the fear that if people really come to get to know us, that they're going to reject us, because we feel like reject was printed on our soul, you know, whenever we felt it from our parents or our peers or whatever. It gets deep inside of you. It really does. And the Lord knows that, and he's not into making superficial puppets. And if the Lord had delivered me of all that I wanted him to deliver me of the first few years I'd been in this church, I would have been free, and just as superficial and empty as I could be. You know, God doesn't give anything cheaply. You know, God's into the real thing. And it's a beautiful thing. It's a very difficult thing. And so, you know, I think what the Lord would say to us is, don't be discouraged. If it's difficult, if you're struggling, if it's hard, if you're seeing the stuff inside of yourself that you've tried to run away from and you don't like, he says, I see it too. And it won't always be there if you just follow me. It won't. You know, I've got my hand upon your life, and I've called you. And I'm going to do it. But your job is to get up every day and not run away and not stay in the shallow waters where everything's safe, but be willing to venture into the deep where it's dangerous and where people are going to see you. And, you know, I wished I could say that we're so mature that you can bare your soul and never feel rejected, but we're human. We're going to reject each other at times. You know, when Jesus was on the cross, it was the ultimate statement of meekness, because he loved those who rejected him. And if we ever get to the place where we can love those who reject us, my goodness, we have arrived, because that's difficult. You know, that's very difficult. But anyhow, that's all I've got to share. Chris is not here to come up here and